Okay, well, I'm sorry for the delay in starting, and grateful to be invited. In fact, I'm grateful for this touring centenary year, which has made it possible for me to do all sorts of traveling and meeting old friends and over again in different and varied places. What I'm going to be talking about overlaps quite a bit with the beginning of Mike Rabin's talk, though my slides aren't nearly as beautiful as his. I first want to once again explain briefly what this notion of universality is, and then explore it in various directions. Well, I can't believe it. Let's see whether this will work. All right, I will just retreat to primitive technology. I give up. At least it's one at a time. So, this is disgusting. Yeah. Okay. So, Turing was faced with the problem of somehow making explicit what a computable process is, and by thinking about what people do when they compute, he came eventually to this very simple-minded scheme in which one is working on a one-dimensional tape divided into squares, each of which can only have one symbol in them, and in which they perform these very simple operations based partly on what the internal state of the machine is. Here you see a machine in state Q facing a tape on which this, oh God. Just a demonstration of the power of universality. facing a square on which the symbol 5 appears, and all it can do at any one state is move one square to the left or one square to the right, changing the symbol in the square that it's on to begin with, and then changing its state. So one can represent a single operation. I think the pointer will work. Yeah. One can represent a single operation by a quintuple like this when you're in state Q, looking at a 5, change it into a 7, go one to the right, and go into a state W. So here you can see the effect of this operation having taken place, where there used to be a 5, now there's a 7, the square looked at is 1 to the right, and the state is W. So here is an actual Turing machine. It's a silly Turing machine, but it just consists of a bunch of these quintuples. Can I make that go away? Nope. Here you see a sequence of operations being carried out by it. Now it was very... It took a lot of nerve for this young man to decide that this simple-minded kind of thing can do anything that can be computed. You're going to be able to make a table of Bessel functions using just these operations. I conjecture that one of the things that led Turing to think of constructing universal machine was confronting a possible paradox with what he had done so far. Namely, if you're in fact given all those quintuples making up a particular machine, maybe coded in some way, and you're given an input to it, well, if you've got those quintuples right in front of you and you have the input, you can perfectly well do what the machine is supposed to do. And that's a simple computational process. So if indeed everything that's computational can be done in this way, you should be able to make a Turing machine to do it. And so he sat down and he made one. He wrote down the quintuples of a universe. It was a pretty buggy program, but when our first try is not buggy? And if you look at his original paper, you can see it's about 2 pages of code. And there it was. But, you know, there it was. He suddenly said, this is a machine that can do anything that can be computed. It's just one machine. Of course, this is an abstract model. It doesn't have any physics in it. It has no engineering. What it has is the most simple-minded possible operations you can think of and an infinite memory. And it makes use of this very large memory because there's enough space to put in a description of any particular computation you want to carry out, reduced to basic steps. And then this machine can use its very simple operations to do whatever that would have done. And this idea that a real machine that somehow was like his abstract model might really be constructible was clearly in Turing's idea from the very first. Well, soon after he arrived in Princeton, he made his way across the corridor that connected Fine Hall, where mathematics was, with the Palmer Physics Lab, and managed to get himself set up in such a way that he could build a binary adder out of relays, which he wound himself. The question then really comes down to if you're going to be able to do practical computations by a machine of this kind, can you have a large enough memory? And will the basic steps be executed fast enough that enough of them can be done to do anything useful? And as a practical matter, if you look at the history of computation since the 1950s, you see that the bigger memories and the faster processing we have until we, you know, get annoying things like this. In 1947, Turing gave a talk before the London Mathematical Society in which he was mainly talking about the ACE, the automatic computing engine that he was involved in the construction of at the National Physics Laboratory near London. And he made explicit the comparison between the his abstract model and this actual machine that he was proposing to build. I considered a type of machine which had a central mechanism and an infinite memory, and which was contained on an infinite tape. It was essential the memory be infinite. Machines such as the ACE may be regarded as practical versions of this type of machine. Digital computing machines all have some very extensive form of memory. The memory needs to be large. And now let's return to the analogy. It can be shown that a single special machine of that type can be made. It works in the following simple manner, and so on. And he describes it. Now, given the technology that was available right after the Second World War, this was a very formidable undertaking. The mechanical relays, which had been used in building computing equipment in the 1930s, were much too slow to be of use. But one of the things that had been learned at Bletchley Park, where Turing was famously now secret for many years, involved in using brains and technology to defeat the German encryption efforts. And one of the things they had produced were these machines they called the Colossus, which did its processing using vacuum tubes. Vacuum tube technology was obviously what to use, but that didn't solve the memory problem. And the thing that Turing was stuck with, the best that was available at that time, was something called the mercury delay line, which is a tube of mercury in which the information is coded in the form of an acoustic wave bouncing up and down the tube. And programming for such a thing must have been an exquisitely difficult undertaking, because you didn't want to write instructions that would be waiting for some data that was down at the bottom of the tube at just the point when you looked for it. And I heard a talk in Cambridge some months back from bitterly attacking the architecture of the ACE, saying it was the ugliest machine he'd ever seen. But he had to cope with giving the programmer tools for anticipating where data was going to be on this silly tube. As far as I know, there was actually a commercial model of this thing called the Deuce that really worked, and I even met somebody who had programmed one in Australia. The next large memory that came online was the so-called Williams memory, which was another amazing gadget. The data was stored as static charge on the face of cathode ray tubes, a typical memory like the machines I learned to program on would have 40 of these tubes, each of which would have a 32x32 array of bits stored. And the problem with this, the engineering problem with this, which Williams brilliantly solved, was that static electricity doesn't stay there. It just fades off into the atmosphere very quickly. And in order to make it work, the von Neumann and his group had made arrangements with RCA Labs to build a special purpose tube to be used for the purpose, and that never worked very well. But William's idea, which, again, like the mercury delay law, he never believed anything like that could really work, was to have the computation cycles alternate with read-around cycles, in which during which the machine would scan successive parts of the memory, read it and rewrite it, so that the data was always being refreshed. And we programmers were warned. I found out the hard way. I got the warning too late on my first attempt. Don't write programs with tight induction loops, because if you hit the same data place over and over again in between read-around cycles, too much charge will land on the tube and it'll splash over and change the value of the memory in neighboring locations. Well, oh, this, those were heroic days. Yeah. Now, when one wants to speak, and I am probably more guilty than anyone else of speaking as an actual physical device, as a universal machine, as an embodiment of Turing's idea, what is it you're looking for? Well, is it really a rich supply of basic operations? Well, if you look at Turing's model, it's hardly a rich supply of basic operations. It, as the previous speaker said, it does nothing. I feel like I'm in a movie theater, crank like this. It's the infinite memory, and it's the large memory coupled with the speed of operations that are the two things that make make an actual physical machine a reasonable approximation to universality. Now, the coming of universal machines, of all-purpose computers, was really a major paradigm shift in a way that is really hard to grasp when you're on the other side of it, because things that are obvious to us were not at all obvious. My favorite example of this is Howard Aiken, who himself was in the business of building these relay machines at Harvard, not very far from here, in the 1930s. And in 1956, he said that it turned out that the logics of a machine designed for the numerical solutions of differential equations coincide with the logic of a machine intended to make bills for a department store. I was regarded this as the most amazing coincidence I have ever encountered. You could just about lease one of those from IBM in 1956. I don't know what the exact date of the 701 was, but it was right around there. Another example I like to point to is that in discussion among engineers as to whether to build machines using binary arithmetic or decimal arithmetic, the discussion hinged on is whether it was better to use binary arithmetic because it would be much faster, but then you'd have to pay the price of having special purpose gadgets to translate between binary and decimal, because the users are going to want the input and output in decimal. And the concept of computation was so primitive that the idea that this transformation could just be done in computer was very novel. You can even see it in if you read the Turing's ACE report, which is well worth reading anyway on many grounds. He talks about the various things that the machine will have to provide, and then one of the things on his list is ways of translating back and forth between binary and decimal. He says, I'm only including this because otherwise people would think I haven't thought of it and left it out, but it doesn't really require any separate mechanism. He had to underline it in that way. Von Neumann's role that Mike talked about earlier is interesting. You know, von Neumann started life as a logician, among other things. He was obviously one of the most brilliant thinkers of the 20th century, and he made some very important contributions to set theory his papers on set theory are still worth reading. And he was really taken by Hilbert's program and devoted a lot of energy to trying to prove the consistency of arithmetic. He published one paper on it. He told his friend and collaborator Goldstein the following story on himself. He said he was working on this problem and encountering a certain difficulty, and then that night he had a dream in which it seemed that the difficulty was overcome. But then it was daytime and he started working again and it was still there in a modified form. That night he dreamt again, and this time he went even further. Then by daylight again the problem wasn't gone. It happened on that very day there was a symposium going on in the Foundations of Mathematics, in which in fact von Neumann was the one who talked about Hilbert's program and what it hoped to accomplish. But at this very round table, a young man named Kurt Gödel announced his results, and von Neumann realized that the jig was up and that he'd been wasting his time. But what he said to Goldstein was, Gödel was very lucky that I didn't dream a third night. Von Neumann was always a great booster of Gödel, praised him to the sky. But he also boasted that after that he never read another logic paper. When he had occasion to write a letter of recommendation for Turing, when Turing was a young man at Princeton, the letter said something like this. He has done good work in almost periodic functions, a subject in which I am interested. But he had to become interested in logic all over again, despite himself. So this is the best he's willing to give. It is easy to see by formal logical methods that there exist codes that are in abstracto adequate to control and cause the execution of any sequence of operations. Alan says thank you. The really decisive considerations are practical nature, simplicity of the equipment, clarity application, and the speed of its handling of those problems. Well, of course, he's perfectly right that when you're going to build the machine, the practical problems are what take precedence. This is what I wrote in my book, The Universal Computer. Before Turing, the suppositions were that the three categories, machine, program, and data, were entirely separate entities. The machine was a physical object, hardware. The program was the plan for doing a computation. The data was the numerical input. Turing's universal machine showed that the distinctness of these three categories is an illusion. A Turing machine is initially envisioned as a machine, hardware, but its code functions as a program detailing the instructions to the universal machine. Finally, the universal machine, in its step-by-step action, sees the machine code as just more data to be worked on. This fluidity is, of course, fundamental to contemporary computer practice. A program is data to the compiler. Here's a piece of shamefaced promotion. This is the centenary edition, very mildly updated from the original 2000 edition. And here is something from a man who doesn't like my book, Edgar Daylight, The Dawn of Software Engineering, From Turing to Deitzer. This is a book that can really be well recommended. It has interviews by a number of people who are very important in the development of software engineering as a really coherent engineering discipline. But he is really annoyed with me because of what I said about those three categories. He said in 1936 the terms hardware and software didn't even exist. And I'll leave you to think about how cogent that is. It's interesting to compare the architecture of the two machines these two people were working on, Turing's ACE and von Neumann's EDVAC. The EDVAC was also based on a Mercury delay line memory. Von Neumann's primary interest was in numerical computation, in particular when the Institute for Advanced Study machine, which was using the electrostatic store memory, was first introduced. Von Neumann used it for hydrogen bomb calculations. Turing was interested in tasks like chess. And he was organized in a minimal way with some of the most basic arithmetic operations done by software. It incorporated a mechanism for pasting together subroutines into a big program. In particular, the idea, which later became very common, of using a stack to manage subroutines so that a program can know by popping from the stack where to continue where it left off at the beginning of the subroutine. In fact, Turing used the colorful words bury and unbury for what we call push and pop. I'm also amused by a letter that he wrote. I keep wanting this. Now it has stopped doing anything. I give up. I can't get this to move even. I don't know why it's stuck. But anyhow, my time is just about up, so I think it's just telling me that. But let me read this. It is very, in a letter he wrote to somebody whose ideas about architecture he didn't care for, was, it is very contrary to the line of development here and much more in the American tradition of solving one's difficulties by means of much equipment rather than by thought. Okay, I'll stop here. I'm done.
Questions to the speaker? Professor Rory.
Okay, I actually want to follow up with a question that I asked Juliet earlier, but now I'll ask you. There is a friend of mine who asked the following joke puzzle. How do you put four elephants in a VW? And the answer is two in the front, two in the back. Now, there is a program, and of course the difficulty in the program is you can't carry out the atomic step, right? Now, this was actually the same difficulty placed by Socrates in the Theaetetus, where he's saying, when you give instructions, you're reducing things to the atomic steps, but the question is whether atomic steps carried out by human beings can be reduced to Turing's erase square, write something on a square, move right, move left, whether the reduction is possible.
Being neither Socrates nor Plato, I pass on that.
Thank you for your talk, and I want to make two historical remarks about the relationship between Turing and von Neumann. Von Neumann, I was in Princeton in the mid-50s and after the Institute computer was finished, was running. I think von Neumann died, passed away about a year after I came there. So the people around von Neumann who worked with him on the machine, the Joniak as it was called, not by him, but by the Institute people, said that he was familiar with Turing's paper, was deeply influenced by it, and on a high level, his architecture was really a Turing architecture. By the way, they also said, and these were electrical engineers who were designing the circuits out of these radio tubes, that whenever they had a design problem that they couldn't solve, they would come to von Neumann and he would settle it within about half an hour. That has got nothing to do with Alan Turing. Now, as a proof of that is something, the influence by Turing on von Neumann, something that I've heard from Hermann Goldstein. At the Moore School of Electrical Engineering, they developed the ENIAC, which was the first large radio tube-based computer. And that was built in order to calculate the trajectories of gun cannon bullets, projectiles. People told me, I'm sorry to digress, that the reason Eckert and Mockley went into that was to do this important work and be exempt from being drafted into World War II. So Hermann Goldstein brought von Neumann to have a look at that machine. The machine was programmed by plugging wires and changing switches. The machine had a memory, also based on radio tubes, where they stored air friction at various temperatures coefficients, which were obviously needed for the calculation of those trajectories. Von Neumann stood there and immediately made a Turing remark. Why don't you store the program in that memory? And that, of course, enabled then that ease of programming and speed of computation. And then he wrote his EDVAC report, which Turing also read, and that and other people in England read, and that was really the impetus for the construction of the first modern computers. Now, another Turing remark. I was at IBM when they came out with a virtual memory machine. So the virtual memory machine extends the internal memory by having a secondary memory, which would now be a disk, and at that time was a tape, switching around pages between the internal memory and the second memory. And that innovation, which was very important, was challenged. The patents were challenged. One of the people they consulted internally how to respond to the challenge was yours truly. And I told them that this is actually the Turing machine idea. There is a potentially infinite tape, meaning memory, and the way he knew that physically you cannot have an infinite tape. So he wrote somewhere in this paper that whenever you run out of memory and you have to move right to a new, yes, right, to a new square, meaning page that doesn't exist, you add a page. And that is logically equivalent to that business of swapping between the internal memory. And this argument was used in the court case, probably other arguments as well. I'm sure Wall Street lawyers made a pile of money out of all of that, but that won the case for them. So it really goes back to that genius, Alan Turing.
Yeah, I'd like to respond or continue as the case may be on that. If you look at the EDVAC report, von Neumann's EDVAC report, you notice one very curious thing about it. At various places, there's a pair of parentheses with nothing between the parentheses. That is, obviously, he intended to add references and never had. But he did have one actual reference, and that was to the fundamental paper of McCulloch and Pitts on neural nets. And that paper, in turn, had only one reference, and that was to Turing's 1936 paper. And in fact, they say in it that they say in it that they regarded the fact that they could mimic a universal Turing computer using neural nets as vindication of their design. And von Neumann adapts their language wholesale in his description of computer architecture in the EDVAC board. Also, I can't help mentioning, since Mike is bringing personal matters into it, and which references his talk once again, is that in 1954, I wrote a program for Pressburger Arithmetic on the Institute for Advanced Study computer. Yes, John.
This question, I think, refers as well to Professor Rabin's talk, so I'll ask it both of you. Turing says, infinite memory is crucial. So as a practical matter, we use a big memory. That reminds me of Courant's famous joke. Take a number close to infinity, let's say 6, it's as close as you'll ever get. So the problem really is, if I have a finite memory, what problems will arise as a result of that? Now, in physics, we have a similar problem. The thermodynamic limit for a system really requires infinite number of degrees of freedom. So what you really look at is, if you don't have an infinite number of degrees of freedom, how do the fluctuations vary with the number of degrees of freedom? Is there some analogous algorithm you can have, or problem you can formulate in terms of computers? If I have a finite memory in the computer, what are the fluctuations? In other words, what are the losses of definiteness that come out of that? And can you make an estimate of how it relates to the number of degrees of freedom you actually have in the existence, in the real memory? I mean, just adding on more tape is, to me, you know, given between a Hale Bose band infinity, you assume you have the infinity, and the potential infinity, we assume you can add as much as possible. So to me, that's not the answer to the question. If you have a machine with a finite memory, what are the consequences of that? How do you estimate that? That's the question I'm really asking.
Uh, I don't really have any cogent answer to that. In practice, what happens is people do what they can, and when they can't write a program to do something with existing equipment, they don't do it.
You mean you can't estimate the potential errors that will arise out of the fact that you have finite memory and how it depends on the number of degrees of freedom you actually have? I think that should be a reasonable problem.
Well, if the program rings a bell and stops, you know, it's asked to execute a command that it can't execute. For example, any programming language will have a max int, that is the largest possible integer. Now, there are for special purposes, there are arithmetic programs available that will supposedly work with integers of any length, and if you're looking for large primes, you'll try to with one of those. But there's still going to be some.
That reminds me of the protocol of overwhelming. It says wait and see what happens and then improvise. Whereas what one really wants is make a model and try to anticipate what's going to happen before it happens.
Well, the problem is that these are universal machines that they use for too many things, so that. The estimate that you would give if you're trying to look for the next prime number is very different than what you would do if you decide you want to make a better iPhone. I don't think that there is a single analog to the physical computer. I don't know, Mike. Do you
have one more question? Did you have one more question? Yes.
I'm happy to address this up in my distant past, but there seems to be a step that you didn't discuss in getting from the Turing to the actual machine, and that's the basic functions that he defined and how that worked out in terms of the binary, like for example substitution. In order to get from the logical concept of substituting, he had to work out a binary formula to do that.
Well, the person who showed engineers how to carry out logical operations in binary arithmetic was Claude Shannon, mm-hmm. in his master's thesis of, I don't know, 1936 or some such date, and it's if you reduce it to a logic problem, then you can do all the ands, ors, and nuts with logical
right,
circuits.
Right, right. But Turing defines, like I said, I'm dredging this up more than 30 years ago, but he defines certain specific logic functions, but once you have all of them, then voila, you have computability. And one of them is substitution, another is constant, another is successor.
Are you talking about Turing machines,
right.
not practical?
But then that had to be translated into binary.
No, why?
Well, but,
I mean, he wasn't.
He had to express it in binary rather than. You
know. No, he didn't. Not for the purposes of that paper.
Okay. Well, they were quibbling about something.
So. Let's have another round of applause for the speaker. We should move on to the next speakers as quickly as the technology behaves.